In 1966, an El Paso theater actor bet his screenwriter friend he could produce a horror movie all on his own. The result was Manos, The Hands of Fate, an incoherent, no-budget movie considered one of the worst films ever made. And yet it did somehow get made, and 50 years later, people are still watching it, which makes Nathan Rabin wonder,
why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to season 4 of Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we've ripped from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it on the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, and joining me this week is Nathan Rabin, a film critic who, over a long career writing for the AV Club, The Dissolve, and now his own website, Nathan Rabin's Happy Place, had discovered a passion for bad movies, the misguided, misunderstood fiascos, and the occasional secret successes. That passion also resulted in his ninth book, The Joy of Trash, which broadens his scope to anything compellingly awful our culture has produced, from the Fyre Festival to Baywatch Nights to the Brady Bunch variety show, to the celebrity cover of Imagine that was somehow supposed to help us get through the pandemic. Nathan, thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell us about Manos, The Hands of Fate, and why the making of a terrible movie would make a good movie.
Sure, no problem at all. One of the reasons why I am talking about this movie, beyond it making a great movie, I think, is that it is one of the motion pictures that I write about for my book, The Joy of Trash. And the idea of The Joy of Trash is to sort of delve deep into the horrible, horrible, objectively horrible things that make life worth living. And that are so much fun to think about and to talk about and to obsess about. And one of the reasons why I feel like Manos, The Hands of Fate, would make for a terrific movie is I feel like there is sort of a subgenre of Hollywood movies, about the making of movies that never should have been made in the first place. I think, yeah, there's kind of this fascinating sort of subgenre of what happens when people who have no business making movies whatsoever decide, damn it, I'm going to go for it. I'm an American. I have free enterprise. And again, I think there is this idea, and this kind of embodies this idea, that anybody could make a movie if they really set their mind to it. And I think specifically people think that you could write a movie if you would write, because who hasn't watched movies? Who hasn't had ideas? And that's, I think, you know, one of the things that is kind of weird when I was a film critic is I feel like, you know, if you're writing about opera, if you're writing about architecture, if you're writing about even theater, those are specialized qualities. And not everybody is into opera and not everybody is into live theater, but everybody watches movies. And everybody loves movies and everybody has ideas about movies. So all you really need to do is just think up an idea, think up some dumb things for your characters to say. And then, you know, bam, the next thing you know, you're standing at the Academy Awards, picking up an Academy Award for best screenplay, just like Sterling Siliphant, who I'm sure I'm getting his name wrong. He has a great name. I don't know if it's a pseudonym, because it sounds very... it sounds like a pseudonym, you know, it's alliterative, it slaps. If I were a star maker, like the people who, you know, sort of created Rock Hudson and Tab Hunter, I would try and create somebody named Sterling Siliphant.
If your character in your movie was named Sterling Siliphant, the audience would go, come on.
Exactly. Come on. Who came up with that crazy idea, Sterling?
But no, he was a real guy who plays in the story. And
totally. Yeah. So I think that's part of it. Is that part of this crazy story about rank amateurs who had no business doing what they're doing, making a motion picture? Is that you have somebody here who is a quintessential pro. You have somebody who is a consummate professional. Not just in the world of film, but in the world of television as well. And yeah, good Lord, he created television shows such as Naked City, Perry Mason, and Route 66. That's very, very impressive. In fact, I'm not entirely sure that he did create Perry Mason. That seems like too impressive of a quality to just kind of toss off there.
He really is the fascinating figure in this, running down the people involved, because Harold P. Mm-hmm. Warren, you know, directs this movie and stars in it.
Yes.
But sort of on the, you know, after conversing with Siliphant, who he had already created those TV shows, he'd already written Village of the Damned. He's had a fascinating career. He went on to write The Poseidon Adventure, The Towering Inferno, and Shaft in Africa. Oh, and Over the Top, the Stallone arm wrestling movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I'm fascinated by this, yeah, like you said, consummate professional, just talking to rank amateur and saying, oh, yeah, you can make a movie.
Well, I think part of that also is you get a sense of Warren from this movie and then from everything that I read about him, that his gift obviously was not being a storyteller. His gift was not, you know, mise-en-scène. His gift was not getting inside the psychology of characters. He seems like he was a schmoozer. You know, he was a salesman. He seemed like he was an affable human being who could talk to anybody. And I'm guessing Sterling Sullivan, being, you know, a consummate professional as well, like, they probably enjoyed. So yeah, while Warren was an extra on Route 66, and I gotta say, he has the quality, he has the talent to be an extra. So again, I think that's one of the fascinating things. Usually people who have no talent don't get past the auditioning unsuccessfully for something stage. But what you have here, and again, I think this is what this has in common with a lot of sort of movies sort of like this, of this ilk, is that you have somebody who says, I will put up my own money, or I will convince people to put up money, and I will not let the gatekeepers of culture, I won't let the fact that, like, even Roger Corman would be like, this is a crazy script, it makes no sense, you can't make a movie for this. I don't care how trashy you are. I don't care how opportunistic you are. Like, this cannot be done. But again, he just kind of put up the money in the same sort of way that Tommy Wiseau, who starred and wrote and directed The Room, which was turned into The Disaster Artist, which I think is kind of a good example of the kind of movie that could be made out of Matters of the Hands of Fate. And you have these characters who are just larger than life, and who are crazy and over the top and so many, like, outlandish sort of stranger than fiction kind of twist to this. I mean, like, the fact that, you know, this movie was made in 66. And then the following year is when Sterling Sullivan won his Academy Award, or he won the year after that for In the Heat of the Night, which, again, you can remember, like, Hale Ashby was the editor of that. Norman Jewison, I believe Terry Southern might have worked on the screenplay for that. So you have these consummate friends, abusing that phrase. But he also, you know, was kind of one of the big screenwriters of the disaster movie boom. You know, he wrote both Poseidon Adventure and The Towering Inferno, which are, if I may give him some very faint praise, those were two of the most important and best disaster movies of all time. Still pretty bad. But they had the biggest friggin' stars in the world. I mean, my God, Towering Inferno. You have William Holden. You know, you have Paul Newman. You have Faye Dunaway, Fred Astaire, Susan Blakely, Richard Chamberlain, Jennifer Jones, Robert Vaughn, Robert Wagner, and O.J. Simpson. So you had everybody on there. You had, like, all of the resources in the world. So there's something, like, very lucky and admirable, something very, very American about the idea of saying, I don't have any real experience, I don't have any kind of a background, but I am going to do this anyway. And I guess the reason why he wanted to do this to begin with was that he was involved in the theater scene. And I think there's this idea that, you know, what are movies but theater with second takes and cameras.
Right, right.
And I think what we learned here is that's very much not the case. And I think it's also, you know, I think he was of the mindset, and a lot of people are of the mindset, that it's not that hard to do horror. That the people who like horror movies are a bunch of idiots. The people who make horror movies are dumb. I think there's this idea that it's just like a step up from pornography, basically.
Right. And that attitude kind of still persists.
Oh, totally. I mean, and one of the other sort of fun things that I talk about in The Joy of Trash is the second season of Baywatch Nights. After a first season did not set the world on fire, I remember I described it as being kind of like a Ralph Wiggum PI, where it's like, what if this sexy lifeguard, what if he became a PI?
It's all crammed by running on the beach in slow motion.
Exactly. And that did not work. So they said, well, what is popular right now? What could we do that the kids seem to enjoy? And one of the most popular shows, one of the hottest shows then, was The X-Files. So they decided, fuck it. We're a horror show now, and we're a science fiction show. And in our world, the supernatural exists. And there are monsters and mummies and evil CD-ROM games, and it is our job to fight evil. Ooh. And what you discover is it's incredibly hard to do horror correctly, and it's hard to do science fiction correctly, especially if you have David Hasselhoff at the center, yeah. Because David Hasselhoff, you know, sort of takes you out of anything. So yeah, I think there was this idea that like, okay, anybody can do horror. You just need a monster. You need some evil. You need a sexy lady. You need some people in peril. And I mean, if you want to like look at the structure of Manos, the Hands of Fate, it's not that different than like Last House on the Left.
Yeah, it does have those elements.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of an archetypal story of you have this all-American family. Which is played by Warren himself. He is the patriarch of this family. And one of the amazing things about this movie, and that makes it so, you know, to use a Malcolm Gladwell term, sticky, you know, one of the things that makes it very memorable, that, you know, causes it to stand out in the minds of people like ourselves who love bad movies and watch lots of bad movies, is that there are so many crazy elements. So one of which is that, you know, Warren is such a doofus and comes off as such a square. And there's almost like a parodic aspect to it, you know, where he's not just like he's almost like a parody of like a clueless, oblivious American male. So they are driving, I think they're going to they're on vacation, and they stop off at this evil place. And the caretaker there is a gentleman named Torgo. And Torgo, I think, is a sort of, say, and might be there, sort of the cult of Manos, the Hands of Fate, is the cult of Torgo. And I think in my piece about it, I sort of said he kind of looks like a cross between Renfield, Dracula's sidekick and helper, and like an insane Vincent Van Gogh, where he's got like this weird, and his face never stops twitching. His body never stops twitching. He just has this ineffably wrong quality to him. Like everything about him says, go away, only evil and sin lie here. And yeah, he was played by, it's very generous to describe him as an actor or to describe this as a performance, but he is portrayed by a singular human being who, if you're like, what is this guy on? The answer is LSD. He was on lysergic acid literally the entirety of the movie. And this is also kind of true of Troll 2, which I think was turned into the best worst movie. Another wonderful, wonderful movie about a terrible, terrible movie that never should have been made.
I think it's also worth mentioning that the entire cast of Manos is people Harold P. Warren could get to work for free.
Oh, yeah, totally. And there was a beauty pageant winner as well. And again, there's just the huckster quality to it. The we're going to do it anyway. I mean, again, there's really kind of a, you know, the quintessential Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, like, let's put on a show quality to this. And then they weren't able to master the art of recording sound live. So everything in here was post-dubbed. And apparently a lot of the post-dubbing was done by the same people. The post-dubbing was not done by the actual actors themselves.
Yeah, it seems like Warren and his wife dubbed a lot of it.
Oh, yeah, totally, totally. So again, there's this sense of it being kind of like outsider art, and that this is not a motion picture as we conventionally understand, as much as this is like a really poignant attempt at making a movie, and that by failing miserably, they ended up coming up with something that was so much more interesting and funny and weird and entertaining than, you know, had they actually known what they're doing, had they had like a baseline level of competence. Because I think that's one of the important things about here is there's no baseline level of competence. There's no competence at all. And it keeps going in these weird directions. So the family stops over and they meet Torgo. And then the focus shifts completely to a character known as the Master. Who really looks like, again, he looks like sort of a parody of like a 1960s horror host. He's like, if you tried to like pass off Svengoolie as like an actual horror character and as, you know, like an actual villain and not just, you know, kind of a cheese ball who introduces silly movies. So the Master awakens from, I don't know, his unholy sleep. And then he has a harem. Basically, because if you're making a silly movie, if you're making a cheap movie, make a movie that has nothing going for it, you can have attractive women in it. And, you know, Roger Corman, you know, it's the cheapest special effect in the world is a busty woman who is right, willing right. to disrobe. So, there is a scene in which Targo gets an eyeful of one of the lovely ladies there. Yeah, there's just something so unbelievably shameless about the whole thing. And so many weird incongruities. Like the fact that, you know, this should have an ominous score. Like, this is ostensibly a horror movie. This is about fright. This is about peril. This is about people who are worried if they're going to die or not. And you have this Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And again, it's just, you wonder when Warren was putting this whole thing together, like, didn't you notice that there's this incredible incongruity between this music being fun and upbeat and silly and you trying to scare people with, you know, this ominous old school tale of evil?
Yeah, it sounds like the whole thing is being filmed on the set of The Match Game.
Oh, totally, totally. And there's also stuff like, you know, that there's like these kids make it out in a car. And they keep getting shown over and over again, and it has nothing to do with the rest of the movie. And again, I think part and parcel of this too is the whole idea was, I will show this Hollywood phony that anybody can make a movie for a very small amount of money.
Well, and I read something strange about the kids making out in the car, which is there was some scene, one of his actresses was hurt or something. And so he couldn't film one of the scenes he wanted to film. And so he just cut in the like whenever he needed to like fill space or replace something, he just put the couple making out in the car. Like, who knows why?
You
were saying about how, you know, these movies made without any competence at all are kind of more engaging because you just baffle at the choices made. That's just mediocre and isn't entertaining.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, and
it's
I
have as a, interesting as this.
Oh, very much so. And like I got a I have a degree from the University of Wisconsin at Madison in radio, television, and film. And one of the things that I learned during my college education is that there are rules. And there are a set of rules that if you want to make a professional movie, if you want to make a movie that looks and feels like other movies, you want to make a movie that feels correct, then you follow this set of rules. And, you know, a lot of filmmakers go to film school and a lot of them don't. And I think it's safe to say that Warren did not know any of the rules of films. And as a result, he made something that does not look or feel like any other movie and something that feels like, again, kind of like a waking nightmare or something that feels like an LSD trip. You know, just like the title. You know, the fact that like manos is Spanish for hands.
I didn't put that together.
So the title of this is basically hands, the hands of fate. So even the title makes no sense and is absolutely ridiculous and is both redundant and kind of pointless. And you know, it's fascinating to me that, you know, they apparently, you know, by 2021 standards, like, this cost about $150,000 to make, which is kind of incredible because it looks like it was made for nothing. And I wonder kind of if it was kind of like a thing of like, you know, The Room apparently cost like $5 million to make because they had no idea what they were doing and squandered an insane amount of money all the time. I think also one of the, you know, sort of crazy things about The Room is that they had that money, you know, and that Tommy Wiseau was a mystery man who was rich for making bad underwear and selling it. And there are all sorts of crazy, you know, and again, just another film of this ilk that I really, really loved and has a very similar kind of aesthetic is Dolomite Is My Name.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is the same sort of thing where, you know, Rudy Ray Moore had no business starring in movies. You know, he was too old, he was too goofy looking, he was too chubby, but he said, screw it, I am going to make my movie and I'm going to be Hero and I'm going to be Shaft and I'm going to be Richard Pryor, and it doesn't matter if nobody believes in me, and this screenplay is insane.
There's something aspirational about that.
Oh, totally.
You know, even as you're saying, oh, look at these idiots who think they can make a movie, they're still like, oh, wow, they're making a movie.
Well, and also like as a young person, I remember watching Ed Wood, kind of to get back to everything. And Ed Wood is actually written about in my book as well. Again, there's something inspirational about it, you know, that this man who could not do anything decided to do everything.
And one of the reasons that Ed Wood works so well and is kind of the pinnacle of this genre of, you know, people making a movie who shouldn't be making a movie, is that Tim Burton has so much affection for Ed Wood himself and the rest of the characters. And as much as a lot of it is, oh, look at these incompetents making this terrible movie, he never loses sight of the joy of making a thing.
Oh, totally.
And Ed Wood's not stopping his lack of talent or money from making the thing he wants to make and really, you know, like sort of following his passion and all that stuff. And that even paired with, oh my God, this guy's making a terrible movie, he should not be doing this, there's still something really engaging about, like, you're still rooting for him.
Oh yeah, well, not only that, but it's like he's making a terrible movie and he actually should do this because he made a movie that is incredibly entertaining and incredibly weird, and that, you know, over a half century from now we're talking about and we're discussing. And I think, you know, Plan 9 from Outer Space, I sort of talk about how that being sort of the big bang for sort of bad movie culture. And this idea of, let's celebrate incompetence and let's find the joy and the entertainment. And yeah, I think with Monos of the Hands of Fate, it became a thing because of Mystery Science Theater 3000. And that was very, very seminal in this idea of, let's, you know, create this world about celebrating the worst movies of all times. And what makes this unique and what makes this weird and what makes this special and joyful. And yeah, and I think the answer with Manos the Hands of Fate is there's a tremendous amount. There's just all sorts of craziness going in every direction. And, you know, as with all the movies that I've described before, you can have people reenact scenes. And the scenes themselves are so weird and so out there and so crazy that if you do a halfway decent job, it's going to be hilarious. I mean, like Disaster Movie. Disaster Movie is a terrible movie. The Disaster Artist. Yeah, and they even had like that thing at the very end there where they have, you know, sort of side by side, the room and what it looks like when they reenacted the scenes from The Room. And yeah, again, I think some part of what makes these special is that there's an affection for the films themselves, there's an affection for the characters, there's an affection for the idea of, let's put on a show and let's make a movie and let's do it even if we don't know what we're doing and we don't have enough money. Again, I think there's an element of wishful thinking, you know, of magical thinking, of if we just believe. Yeah, I think also, you know, there are all these, you know, Cinderella stories of, you know, Robert Rodriguez, that he had $7,000 from doing medical studies and he made a movie with that $7,000. And because of that, he went on to make many terrible movies for more money.
But then there's...
You could say he still doesn't know how to make a movie, but it was a lot more infectious when you're making a movie for $7,000 than when you're making a crappy movie for $100 million.
Oh, of course. And there's also Sam Raimi, who, you know, made Evil Dead for $800, and it looks like, you know, he had half the budget. And then he's also very good at making $100 million movies. And so I think part of the aspiration is, you know, if this guy just had a little more talent...
Oh yeah, and I think about I was 18 years old when Clerks and Pulp Fiction were released. I mean, 1984 was the most magical year in the history of cinema. I think I have to make a pretty strong case for that. But yeah, I worked at a video store, and I'm like, I'm going to be a filmmaker because that's the coolest thing in the world to do. And you don't need money, you don't need resources, you don't need connections. You can get $30,000 from your buddies and shoot a movie in like a week and a half at a convenience store, and then you're a filmmaker and a player, and people have to pay attention to you. And again, I think kind of the one of the smart things that Kevin Smith did in making Clerks is he made a style of movie that's pretty cheap, and you don't need sets, you don't need special effects, you don't need all of these different things, as opposed to, again, Plan 9 from Outer Space. Like, this is a war of the worlds.
Right.
You have aliens, you have attacks, you have all of these different things. Like, yeah, you're choosing to make a very expensive, very involved type of movie. And then, yeah, with Manos of the Hands of Fate, again, I think he was kind of a, let's just make it cheap and quick and have just this kind of salacious, kind of simple story. But they screwed up so tremendously that you ended up with something that, again, it sort of feels more like outsider or folk art than, you know, your typical B movie.
And something so compellingly weird, we're still talking about it 55 years later.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And also, too, I mean, I think, you know, sort of the character of Torgo I think that's an Academy Award. There's an Academy Award in that, you know, and part of it is I've got a podcast where I talk about the movies of Nicolas Cage and John Travolta, and he's way too old for the role, but I think Nicolas Cage would be pretty perfect as Torgo, and he would, you know, he would be able to really let his freak flag fly. Because nobody
say what
is
you will
weirder
about,
than Torgo.
Yeah, well, say what you will about the cast of Manos. It's just people that, you know, the director could get to work for free and everything. John Reynolds, who plays Torgo, and Tom Naiman, who plays the Master, they are genuinely really compellingly weird.
They commit, definitely. And again, I think one of the things that makes the Master such a fascinating character is that he's kind of a henpecked husband, where he kind of emerges from his slumber and his you know, his harem are all like, why don't you, you know, and he's so clearly annoyed. And there's this, again, this sort of crazy incongruity of he's ostensibly this very powerful, very dark, very sinister figure. And he's like, hey, yay, women, am I right? You can't get a word in. Even if you're the personification of evil, they still run you ragged.
Well, do you want to talk about casting for the rest of it? And who do you have in mind to direct this?
That is a good question. You know, the guy who directed Mandy, I think would be an incredible choice. In part because he is, I only learned this after I saw Mandy and was very, very impressed by it. But he is the son of the man who directed Cobra.
Wow.
Which kind of makes sense and kind of doesn't make sense because Cobra is, you know, very schlocky and very vulgar and very commercial, but it also feels a lot like Mandy. And it also involves, again, has kind of this, you know, sort of psychedelic, kaleidoscopic, you know, sort of nightmare dreamlike quality to it. And also, you know, involves killers, an aggregation of crazy killers. So Panos Cosmatos. I think would be a very, very interesting person to, especially, you know, he could reunite with Nicolas Cage. And who knows? They could do that de-aging thing that they did in The Irishman that everybody really, really liked. And then, for the role of Naaman, the man who put it all down, who would be good for that? Let's see. Michael Shannon. I'm in kind of a Michael Shannon kind of mood. I feel like he's good for everything. And he definitely has that quality of seeming very sinister and very otherworldly and literally larger than life. And then, for the director / star / husband, I think Greg Kinnear would be good because I feel like Greg Kinnear has that quality of being, you know, kind of a handsome dad type and kind of having a bit of a prodic element of it as well. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the fact that he, you know, started out with, you know, Talk Soup as a guy who, you know, said funny things about dumb TV shows.
One of my favorite roles of his was Mystery Men, where he plays the square jawed sort of all American hero, but to the point of absurdity.
Oh, well, and also, I mean, like he also was in a movie about a filmmaker of sorts called Autofocus. Which, again, I think is one of, I think the movie itself has some real problems. But I feel like his performance is wonderful. And Willem Dafoe's performances are both wonderful. Oh, yeah. And they both kind of deserve to be in a better movie and less of a kind of a hacky over the top type movie. It actually was executive produced by Alexander and Karaziski, who have kind of made their bones creating movies like this. You know, primarily, you know, they wrote screenplay for Ed Wood, and then they wrote screenplay for Dolomite Is My Name as well. So we can get them on board, you know, writing the screenplay or executive producing, or at least doing the script doctoring for our motion picture about Manos, the Hands of Fate, because they love this and they're very good at making funny, empathetic movies about real life characters.
Yeah.
And they also have a tendency to make them kind of sort of saint-like. You know, there's something like very childlike and, you know, that it makes it endearing. You know, the fact that Ed Wood doesn't hate his characters and it's not misanthropic, not like, haha, look at these idiots. But it can also be, I mean, like, think about, you know, the fact that, you know, Dolomite Is My Name, that Rudy Moore broke all of the rules to make Dolomite. And then they observed all the rules, making a very reverent, funny, touching, but also very, very conventional motion picture.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking at directors, I was thinking, like, who's made these other kinds of movies? But I thought, maybe you want somebody who hasn't, maybe that seems like sort of too on the nose. But I'm also thinking, like, you don't want this to be like a big budget, like Apatow production. You kind of want somebody who's a scrappy underdog. And so I landed on Bobcat Goldthwait.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's great.
Yeah. And he hasn't directed a comedy since 2011's God Bless America. He's done a horror movie since, a couple of documentaries, but like he has such an affection for outsiders and screw ups. His early films like Shakes the Clown, Sleeping Dogs Lie, World's Greatest Dad, they're all one way or another about people doing their best, which still isn't very good.
Yeah, and that
feels like a good fit for Harold Warren.
No, I totally co-sign. I like my choice as well, but I think Bobcat would also be a terrific choice for this.
There's no wrong choice here. It's kind of fun to throw out all the different people we could.
It's funny
on the show. Sometimes we get into like, could we get Michael Shannon for our made up movie?
Well, Michael Shannon was in a Christmas furry comedy.
But I also have guests who are like, well, okay, this actress has been dead for 15 years, but I think she'd be perfect.
That's true. And again, I think Nicolas Cage too old for the role. And Bart, because again, one of the things that made John Reynolds so fascinating is that he committed suicide. And that it wasn't a matter of, you know, he played this amazing role and then he went on to do other things. Like, you know, you can't even like, you know, see him at a sci-fi or horror convention.
I think it was before the movie even was released.
Right. It was pretty crazy. And yeah, according to Wikipedia, apparently it was kind of a similar thing to The Room, where they had a premiere. They said, damn it, world, we're going to show you our movie. And yeah, apparently the girl in it wept. Because she's like, oh my goodness, I thought we were making something that wouldn't be a bizarre abomination. And then also, why are a different voice coming out of my mouth? But even that would be like giving it too much credit to be like, because again, you have sort of a Godzilla level of dubbing, where there's a disconnect between what people are saying and the movements that their mouths are making.
And apparently, like Jackie Naiman, like Tom Naiman, who played the master, his 7-year-old daughter is the daughter in the family that's central to the story. And yeah, apparently she was very freaked out by that. But then many years later, as an adult, she made a very tongue-in-cheek like a sequel to Manos the Hands of Fate.
She
eventually bought in.
Well, that's the thing about it too. It's like, I feel like you have, again, sort of like Troll 2, where you kind of have this fascinating, as seen in Best Worst Movie, you have these very different attitude towards it. Or Michael Stevenson, who actually would be good for this because he's also a very talented director. Beyond Best Worst Movie, he did a really neat Bob Odenkirk comedy called Girlfriend's Day. But yeah, that you have, you know, the director of it. It was this Italian fellow who took himself very seriously. It's like, I'm going to make an important statement about vegetarianism and the American people. He was like, why is everybody laughing at my horror movie? Like, that's sad. Yeah. I didn't. I wrote a book about Postal. Called Postal, and Uwe Boll is so angry and sad that people think he's the worst filmmaker in the
world. He just wants to fight people.
He's just like I'm not the worst filmmaker. Like, there are all these people and they're worse than me, and these people blah blah blah, blah. And I'm like, it's an honor to be considered the worst filmmaker in the world. Like Ed Wood, like people said that because they loved him and because they thought he was an interesting, fascinating guy, and they wanted to talk about his movies and rewatch these movies. Yeah, if somebody says you're the worst filmmaker in the world, that means they have an opinion about you and they feel strongly about you and they're going to give you a superlative.
And they've watched your movie. And, you know, full marks to Tommy Wiseau. Like, he's really embraced that he's famous for having made this bad movie and has kind of taken the tack of like, this thing I made entertained a lot of people, maybe not for the reasons that I intended, but.
Well, and also I think even then, like, you know, they're sort of famously, he started describing it as like a dark comedy. And what makes that so poignant is that it's not tongue in cheek. It's not supposed to be funny. It's like this somebody's X-ray, you know, a cinematic X-ray of somebody. So yeah, and apparently Warren also thought that he had made the worst movie of all time, but also was proud of it. And I think that kind of duality sort of speaks to what makes it so fascinating. And that, like, yes, objectively speaking, terrible movie. This is an incompetent movie. This is a movie that is made by rank amateurs. But because of those factors, not despite those, it's also, you know, has that X factor that makes people remember it and talk about it and recommend it. And I had heard about this movie for years and years and years. And, you know, I didn't finally see it until I have got a feature on my website called Control Nathan Raven 4.0. And for anywhere between $65 to $100, I will watch a movie that you tell me to. So I watched Manos, the Hands of Fate, and it was an amazing experience because it more than lived up to my most feverish expectations. And I'm like, I 100% understand why people are obsessed with this movie. You know, I 100% understand why this is up there in the pantheon of great, terrible movies.
One more small bit of casting I want to throw out, because this got into the pantheon of terrible movies, like a lot of bad movies, through Mystery Science Theater 3000. And so one other character who was, we don't know a whole lot about, but was fascinating to me, was another person who sounds like he has a made-up name, Colbert Caldwell, who was a lawyer friend of Warren's who let him film in his office.
Oh, wow.
And just seemed to be like a very, you know, kind of straight-laced, regular, you know, lawyer who was just like, oh, yeah, this sounds great. Let's do it. And so it seems like a small role, and you just kind of want a regular kind of straight man there. But I feel like that's where you throw in Joel Robinson as a cameo.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Because he's so central to the story of this becoming, you know, infamous and kind of beloved as a bad movie.
Yeah. And I think there's also a very, very big, juicy role that we haven't talked about before, which is Sterling Siliphant, who, again, you know, a big deal, a big marker. And I'm actually looking up on Google now. He's actually a pretty handsome guy. You know, like, he could definitely be an actor in his own right. So, God, who conveys? You could do like stunt casting and get like Judd Apatow. or somebody who genuinely is sort of
who's actually that guy in real life.
I mean, I'm thinking Tim Spike Jones, I think, would be an interesting choice for it.
Oh yeah, and he's done some acting.
Yeah. And not only does he act, but like if you he's one of those guys where it's almost unfair how talented he is, because if you just like look at like his resume as an actor, it's like Jackass, The Wolf of Wall Street, Three Kings. It's like you've appeared in nothing but great, important movies that like people care about.
Well, he's not an enviable position because that's not his main thing.
No,
he can really choose his roles. Like Bowie was always in good movies because he didn't need to do this.
Well, I've written about all of Bowie's movies. He was in a lot of terrible movies.
Okay, all right, maybe.
And a lot of the time, again, it was about a third great, and then two thirds. Like, why on earth is he in this piece of garbage?
All right, fair enough.
And again, part of the answer was that he didn't need it. So you got a sense of like somebody made a good impression at lunch, and he's like, "I'll be happy to shoot a day on your weird 9/11, you know, internet stock drama movie." But yeah. So it definitely would be an interesting role for Sterling Siliphant.
I came up with James Urbaniak.
Oh, I think that would also be very, very good.
Mostly because I was thinking of him playing Robert Crumb in American Splendor, which is kind of a similar role. He's this smart, creative, eccentric who's successful, but he's still interesting to hang out with an unknown who has some interesting ideas. Because the origin story that I read from Manos was that Siliphant and Warren were like sitting in a diner, and Warren bet him that he could make a movie horror movie on his own without really any resources. And he started writing the script on a napkin, and off to the races.
Well, and also I love the fact that Warren won. Like, they had a bet as to whether or not he could make a movie, and he made a movie widely considered one of the worst of all time, but it was a movie.
And he made
it. So there's a bit of a Rocky, you know, the original Rocky quality, where you lose and you win at the same time. And you win, and not by, you know, making a movie that's a big hit, or, you know, making a movie that, like, gets you a contract for Warner Brothers. But rather you win because you get it. And come hell or high water, you manage to realize your creative vision, even though you had no business making a movie, even though people think you're crazy, even though people are literally not only laughing at you in the moment, but they're laughing at you 55 years later. But he did it. And I feel like, yeah, that's why, you know, this could be a happy ending. Just suicide aside.
Oh yeah,
I think that there could definitely be, you know, sort of a heartwarming, you know, plucking at your heartstrings element to the third act of our movie, because again, they succeeded.
Yeah, they made a premiere, and even though, like, I read that at the premiere they got a limo to drop the stars off to make it real Hollywood, but they could only afford one. And not everybody could fit in the limo. So they dropped off half the cast, drove around the block, picked up the rest, and then dropped them off in the same limo.
That is so great.
So again, there's still this kind of absurdist underdog feel to it. But in any creative field, there's aspiring writers, musicians, actors, filmmakers who have all the ideas in their head in the world, but don't follow through. And I always give credit to people who did the thing.
Well, I also do, like, I mean, just think about, you know, one of the movies that I wrote about recently for Travolta Cage and the Travolta Cage Project was Wild Hogs, And in 2007, this movie starring John Travolta, Martin Lawrence, Ray Liotta, William H. Macy, and Tim Allen, grossed $250 million at the box office. $250 million. It didn't just make $100 million. It made $100 million 2.5 times over. And that movie has been completely forgotten. Nobody talks about Wild Dogs. It's to be like, wasn't it terrible when they made that horrible movie? And this movie, which was, you know, made $0 and cost $0 and literally was inspired by a bet and inspired by like a stubborn sense of anybody can do this, not just somebody who's smart and talented and knows what they're doing, will be remembered for decades and decades and decades to come. And like I said before, it has a sort of a place of pride in the pantheon of movies that are so terrible that they're kind of wonderful and great.
So that's our movie. If you have any thoughts on Manos, the Hands of Fate, or ideas for other movies that need to get made about movies that maybe didn't need to get made, hit us up on Twitter at YMovie. Thanks again to Nathan Rabin. Check out his writing at nathanrabin.com, where he's currently 80-some articles into the Travolta Cage Project, reviewing every single movie from the wildly inconsistent but always compelling careers of John Travolta and Nicolas Cage. You can also buy his new book, The Joy of Trash, on his website and on Amazon, and previous books like The Weird Accordion to Al, an in-depth analysis of every song Weird Al Yankovic ever wrote, The Weird A Coloring to Al, a Weird Al coloring book based on the previous book, You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, about the devoted but much maligned fandoms of both Fish and the Insane Clown Posse, and many more books about pop culture, both trashy and otherwise. And you can read student journalism, hear college radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. Keep yourself sane, get yourself boosted. We'll be back next time on
Why is this not a movie?